You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Sia, you've been chatting with Gerald Guralnick at Brown University, one of five men alongside Peter Higgs, credited with independently coming up with the theory behind what's called the Higgs mechanism, which gives particles their mass. So I understand he met a lot of skepticism when he first presented the model.
Yes, that's right. In light of the recent discovery of a particle that really looks like it could be the Higgs, Guralnick has been reminiscing about his role in the 1960s in developing the theory, which he didn't immediately even realise would relate directly to the physical world.
From my point of view, it came from a theory that I first started worrying about the aspects of Build It when I was a graduate student. And we worked through various guises of it and came up with a general principle and then an example of the principle, or really it's called the mechanism, and came up with a simple example of a mechanism. And when we proposed this in a paper that I did with Hagen and Kibble, we had no idea that in any way this had anything to do with physical reality. So I guess my reaction is just total amazement. And in a way, it shows how physics progresses, right? You probe a little here, prod a little there. You make some guesses. Then you do some measurements, and then you do some very good measurements. And all of a sudden, you discover the path that nature's taken. And we found that path, but really honestly, unknowingly, we found it as an interesting mathematical example of how you solve a set of equations that start looking out, and are the equations that are used to describe ordinary electromagnetism, but we found another solution that people had never suspected.
So that sounds like you were working on this very abstract sort of esoteric calculation as a grad student. Why were you given that problem, or was it something that you found interesting?
What happened is the following. Must have been about 1960, Nambu with Yana Licinio published a very interesting paper in which they looked at interactions, a quantum field theory that had interactions between four fermionic particles. Now, such theories had been studied as a model for the weak interactions. The weak interactions being the thing describing the processes that happen, for example, in the Sasan. They're the processes that describe nuclear decay, and they certainly had been observed experimentally, and people had written down a quantum theory that at least phenomenologically described these things. But that theory had a lot of flaws. It wasn't renormalizable. It meant that beyond the lowest approximations, it diverged and people didn't really understand how to calculate it. But what they did was look at similar theories, and they weren't specifically looking at the weak interactions, and demonstrated that there were solutions different from the ones that people had normally been looking at. Back then, there was mostly only one way to solve a quantum field theory, and that was what was called a coupling constant perturbative method. And the solutions to that theory, there was a prescribed method for calculating them. You got an answer or you didn't answer, and that get an answer. And that was really the only thing we understood. And then Nambu and Yana Licinio showed a way to get another answer. And that what they discovered, what they demonstrated, was in a way a relativistic analog to stuff that had been done by condensed matter theorists with superconductivity. But that was striking. It was amazing. And the other thing that was amazing about the answers that they wrote down is that the answers that they wrote down had less symmetry than you would have expected from the equations that they came from. And so they were called, those solutions were called broken symmetry solutions. And you paid a price for having less symmetry. If you, in a field theory, had less symmetry than you thought, then the equations indicated, associated with that was always a zero mass particle. And that came to be known as the fact that this was true, at least in the theories they looked at, was called eventually, came to be known as an Ambu-Goldstone theorem, because there was actually a theorem showing that under certain circumstances that only happened. And my advisor, this is being a little long-winded, but sort of trying to set the tone of the time. So there was these new solutions no one ever expected. They had a constraint on them, namely massless particles. We didn't know much about massless particles. I mean, the only observed massless particle was the photon. We expected then that the neutrinos were massless. That turns out not to be true. The graviton's supposed to be massless. We still haven't seen one. So a massless particle was a very rare thing, and that prediction seemed a little bit strange. So my advisors told me to take a look at these theories and pointed out that a man by the name of Barakane had used theories like this to make a different theory of electromagnetism, one that gave the same answers but started from apparently different equations in the beginning. So it was a theory that just looked like what we knew and understood to be the behavior of light in the presence of matter, but the equations appeared to be different. And so my advisors told me to take a look at those. And that's where it all started for me. And then there was a whole series of things where I thought, gee, this is really interesting. But now from this particular theory that was a broken symmetry theory that seemed to duplicate electromagnetism, you had a guaranteed massless photon. It must be possible in the normal theory of electromagnetism to guarantee the photon there was massless. And people had argued for a long time that theory did have a massless photon, but Schwinger had just shown that the arguments probably were not valid. So there was a challenge. How do you know from the theory itself, how do you know that the photon particle of light actually carries no mass? And that's how I got dragged into the whole thing. And there was a whole set of evolution of these ideas from where I tried to understand what the theoretical reason was for the photon having zero mass. I didn't believe the statement Schwinger had given, and that progressed into showing that the Goldstone theorem, that Nambu-Goldstone theorem that had come out of these models initially proposed by Nambu and Janowicz-Sinil, was actually a theorem that only held in special circumstances that were not obeyed by what are called gauge theories, or theories that are electromagnetic-like. And all this, putting all of this together through a series of fits and starts, led to the Gronig-Kibble paper, which was the one that showed, one, that the Goldstone theorem is not valid for gauge-like theories, and indeed that there are models, the simple model that seems to be correct, that there are models where the photon becomes a massive vector meson, and so you could write down a new theory which didn't have numbers of unobserved massless particles, so that the original Nambu theory, which was a new solution, if you like, to old equations, but a new solution with less symmetry, was actually physically useful because you didn't have to deal with a horde of massless particles that just weren't observed physically.
So, you know, tell me, you know, you talked about this this paper, which became very important, that you worked on. Was it very difficult to actually do the work to get out that result? Or was it something that, you know, once you were on the path, it fell out very naturally?
It was very hard to get on the path. Let me explain to you why. Because of this theorem and because of this obsession, I think it's fair to say that I had to prove that in the accepted theories that there was a dynamical That is a clear reason that you could predict in advance of any difficult calculation, that there was a dynamical reason that the particle of light had was massless. I actually made a proof, which I put in my thesis, and which my advisor read over and accepted, or had the wool pulled over his eyes. And my PhD thesis at Harvard actually had a chapter in it proving the photon was massless. And it was in the thesis exam where I was standing up in front of these learned gentlemen when a man by the name of Sidney Coleman, who you've probably heard of, he was a very, very smart man, very quick-witted, very sharp tongue, was looking at these results during my exam and told me, I don't know exactly why, but these results are just wrong. And the end result was that, I mean, I was very lucky. Despite that, I passed my thesis exam, but I had to take that chapter out of the thesis. Now, needless to say, that irritated me very much, but he was right. It was clear that when you put that chapter to hard scrutiny, it just wasn't right. So I went off to Imperial College still wondering why in the world the photon in the normal equations, why you couldn't say that it had zero mass. And so as soon as I got to Imperial College, where I was fortunate enough to go there on a National Science Foundation fellowship as a postdoctoral fellow, I started looking at this question again. And I proved, or I thought I proved, a wonderful theorem, which actually showed that the photon was massless. But it turned, and I wrote up a paper and sent it off to PhysRev Letters. And 2 or 3 days after I wrote the paper, I realized that my proof was absolutely correct, except in one very special case. And I had missed that special case. That special case happens to be the case that is of physical interest in electromagnetism. So I had proof. I had written down a very clear proof, you know, using equations, no approximations, that initially appeared to show the photon was massless. And then I discovered the proof had one exception. And therefore, part of that paper, most of the paper was right. It had some interesting things in it, but one part of that paper was wrong. And that exception was essentially showed that the assumptions for the Nambu-Goldstone theorem were wrong in the case of normal electromagnetism. That was the whole clue. Because then from that point, I knew that the Nambu-Goldstone theorem did not apply to, in fact, what turns out, the physically measurable parts of electromagnetism. Electromagnetism has lots of extra freedom put in that you need to make the thing look invariant under relativistic transformations. And that extra freedom is what's called gauge invariance. And it turned out in a minimal gauge that only told you about physics, that the Nambu-Goldstone theorem that I had derived, a very special one, did not apply, and it had to do with the fact that integrals that you thought were convergent at infinity and leading to a time independent charge just didn't behave that way. It was a very subtle effect, incredibly subtle. And as soon as I knew that, the problem was to find a model. And with Hagen and Kibble, I sat down and we found a model almost instantly. In fact, we knew the model for all of this at the end of April. But given the fact that I'd made lots of mistakes working up to this, we were very, very worried about it. And we did every check we could imagine on the model before we published it, because we were afraid that this would be a third mistake in this series of very subtle mistakes. And my collaborators certainly did not want to add add their names to this series of wrong, of almost right, ideas that I'd had. So we spent a long time checking it, and then we finally published a paper that had both what's now called the Higgs mechanism and a detailed explanation of why it worked for an understanding of it. Something that I should say in for advertising for a paper, none of the other publications in this area had. We had an exact explanation of why the theorem failed with details. And then we had a model based on what's called scalar electromagnetic theory, which is related to the models that the other people had. It's slightly different, but the reason it's different has to do with the way we handle the infinities of the theory. But that's the history. That's how we went from that thing. We went. It was not easy. It was a series of starts of elation with feeling that the answer was found, that something really interesting had happened, and it was iterative. And we finally got it all right. And, looking back, certainly then, the understanding of it and the theory and all this development was pretty radical. In fact, no one believed it initially. I was told that with no uncertain terms every time I gave a seminar on it, that it was just nonsense, including by Werner Heisenberg.
Wow. Why? Why did they think it was nonsense? What was it about it that seemed so surprising?
First of all, the broken symmetry thing bothered people a lot. People were used to working with perturbation theory, and this was a different approach. It turns out it's an iterative approach, but not in the parameters that people really use. These were really entirely different solutions to the theory than anyone had anticipated. Now, looking back on it, one shouldn't be surprised. The equations we use are horribly nonlinear, and nonlinear equations always have multiple solutions. But we were just, as physicists, we only had one set of solutions that we were looking at. So these were new solutions. The solutions that we were writing down had less symmetry than the initial equations suggested. And in fact, one of the symmetries that we were breaking is the symmetry I mentioned before, which is called gauge invariance. Now, this is a peculiar symmetry. It's a little different than other symmetries. And there was a residual amount. This is sort of subtle, and it's not even, as far as knowing any of the book. The theory that we ended up with had a residual amount of gauge invariance, but didn't have the full gauge invariance of the initial theory. And that drove people nuts, and for good reason, given the history of things. So people looked at this and said, you just can't do this. It's just wrong. And our response is, hey, we did this very carefully. Here are the consistency checks. This is a leading order approximation. You can show it's consistent. You can show exactly doing what degree of exact analysis we can do with such theories that this makes sense. But people, it took a long time before people accepted it, and they looked at it, and and back then all of us were very, very young, except for Kibble. We had just gotten our PhDs. And so, here, particularly this conference that Heisenberg was at, it was at Heisenberg's honor, in fact, and Hagen and I were there, and might well have been the youngest people there. And here are these two physics children talking about this new result, which didn't make any sense to anyone given the history. And looking back, I can understand their skepticism. At the time, it was shattering.
Do you remember what Heisenberg said to you?
Yeah, he said, loosely speaking, I don't remember the exact words, but loosely speaking, he said, this theory is junk.
Okay. So, that would be shattering, like you said. Wow, gosh.
And I argued a little with him, but, Heisenberg was, in many ways, certainly one of the major founders of quantum mechanics, and he was a brilliant fellow, no doubt about it. And he was a lot younger than I am now when he told me this, and it was just scary. And I thought after this discussion, and after having given this talk before a very elite audience, where I was really pounded in the questions section, where people just really went after me. And, you know, I didn't do a terribly skillful job at that stage answering the questions. I was just mostly scared. But I was shattered. I thought I would never get a job. So that was my personal experience with that. And indeed, even later on, I did get fortunate enough to get a job at the University of Rochester as a postdoctoral job after Imperial College. And they had a great man there by the name of Robert Marshak. And he, along with George Sudarshan, was responsible for the V-A theory of weak interactions. And without that, we would never have been able to work our way up to the standard model. And he was a big name at Rochester. And I came to Rochester and, in fact, was worrying about maybe taking this model, thinking maybe one could explain the weak interactions this way. This is something Marshak was expert at because of his discovery of V-A theory. And I talked to some about it, and he said, you know, this might be interesting, but I've got to tell you right now, you've got to stop. You're never going to survive as a physicist. You can't do this anymore. Here, read this paper by Weinberg in Physical Review Letters. I think it's interesting. See what you can understand about it. Maybe you can push it a little further. So I read this paper by Weinberg and, in fact, wrote a paper on the mass splitting of the pi mesons, right, from going from the mechanism of mass generation for everything to writing a paper on the mass splitting of pi mesons due to electromagnetic interactions based on Weinberg's ideas. Well, Weinberg went along and was working on our stuff, so it was very amusing.
So, you know, now looking back, you know, you refer to this as, you refer to sort of working out the Higgs mechanism in your paper, but at the time it didn't have that name, and as you sort of mentioned, you didn't know that it was going to be physically relevant in the way that it has turned out to be. So how did that realization come about?
Well, the first thing that happened was the Weinberg Salam realization, of the unified theory of weak and electromagnetic interactions, based on some of the ideas, group ideas that Glashow had earlier. And in order for that to work, you really, that the cornerstone of that was our result, the result that you could generate mass for gauge particles through this mechanism. And so that there was no residual Goldstone bosons present that you didn't want, that you could generate mass. And that was the basis for the whole unified theory. At that stage, it began to look like this was just the way to go. But, of course, no one had, and no one did until this year, for certain, observe anything corresponding to the massless scalar excitation that you needed for that simple model we came up with. And so for a long time, there was evidence that this whole mechanism was right. But this discovery of the boson, if that's what has happened, and which, as I said before, I think is extremely likely, there's a lot more measurement that needs to be made. But the discovery of the boson then just wraps the whole thing up, at least for this part of the standard model. So, you know, the realization that it was important came on over a period of many years.
Did you think that it would be discovered, or that it would be discovered in the time frame that it has been? I mean, we've had to see, you know, a whole big accelerator being built, you know, which had its own problems in sort of starting up and running. When you sort of watched that over the years, did you think it was going to happen?
No. I mean, I didn't know how it couldn't happen, but that it was not seen, that it was so hard to observe, was very bothersome. And you remember, I mean, this is a long time. I went you know, from being barely out of college to sadly what probably can only be described as being an old man without this being discovered, right? So this, was it a surprise? Maybe not entirely a surprise, but I was giving up hope that it would be seen. Now, if it wasn't seen, as you know, you've surely heard and read the speculation, it'd been extremely interesting. But how you'd held together all the good results of the standard model, how all that had been made to work without this mechanism and some realization of it through some scalar-like excitation, even a composite, that was an interesting question. And it could be that we would have had to have dumped much of the standard model. That seemed very unlikely. But it also seemed very unlikely, you know, I'd given up hope of finding this thing. But on the other hand, we haven't been building accelerators like we used to, right? The money has been slow in coming. It takes a long time to do things. And so the time scale has become extremely stretched compared to what it would have been, say, if we'd finished the superconducting super collider in this country.
You know, when you visit the LHC or when you see photographs of it, I mean, it's awe-inspiring. It's just huge. Did you imagine that it would need something just, you know, that physically big and costing so much money to make this discovery, you know, years back?
No, I certainly didn't. I mean, the thing is awe-inspiring. I'd like, you know, I've seen the life-size photograph or artistic depiction of the experiments. I'd really like to see the actual experiment at some stage of, you know, when it's down, just to see the whole thing. But it's just an amazing, the scale's amazing, the detailing that goes into it, the engineering, the experimental work is just fantastic, right? It's awe-inspiring that you could make something like this, that is so sophisticated, it can do such fine measurement, and that, you know, it clearly works. It works very well. And you know, it just, it gives me nothing but respect for my fellow scientists and engineers. What a magnificent achievement. Have you seen it?
I have. I went down before they started it up, and I got stuck down there, in fact, which was very exciting and a little bit worrying.
Yeah. As long as they didn't fire it up, you're okay.
Well, I don't know. I managed to take my phone down there and it stopped working after that, so I'm a little bit worrying about what might have happened while I was there. I haven't developed any superpowers, though, so I guess I'm okay.
No, it's an incredible experiment. I mean, the whole thing is really inspiring. It shows, you know, it shows what we can do, you know, and I certainly hope this is not our last accelerator.
If you had to take bets on the mass, what would you have, what value would you have bet on, and what do you think of the value that they found?
I was betting people it was about 120, so it's right where I would have guessed. But as you know, the theory doesn't really directly constrain it. It's only, you know, sort of internal consistency checks of things that are done with the standard model. But the basic theory does not constrain the mass of the Higgs boson. That's why you really don't know where to look.
So what do you think is interesting about the actual mass that they found?
Well, one, that it's so very heavy, right? I mean, this is a really heavy particle. And I would guess that, you know, given everything that's happened, oh, historically, maybe that shouldn't be so surprising. But it is very heavy. And beyond that, I'm not sure what to say. But it is, again, the consistency arguments can be made that it's roughly where you would expect it to be from the rest of the empirical results of the standard model, right? And people have done a lot of nice calculation on them, trying to set ranges for it, and basically it falls in those ranges.
Now, you brought up the superconducting super collider that never happened. What are your hopes now for the future of the LHC, what the LHC could find, and maybe for the future of, I guess, future particle physics discoveries?
Well, I think the LHC is just beginning. I mean, this is pretty impressive, right? The thing isn't even running at full energy. And already they've made at least one major discovery and confirmed most of, maybe all, but certainly most of the earlier particle accelerator results with unprecedented accuracy. So, you know, it would be nice if we could find some clear trace or hint of supersymmetry. Perhaps we'll start getting insight into dark matter and dark energy. There are lots of things you can hope for because, you know, we're really at the beginning of this puzzle. There's so much we don't know. And the standard model itself is obviously very phenomenological. We've got to do a lot better than that. But we're going to have to understand, I'm pretty sure, in order to get it right, we're going to have to experimentally have to understand more structure than we do. I hope the LHC start, particularly when they ramp up the energy, that we start seeing some of that.
Going back to the announcement, I mean, it was huge news around the world. And, you know, you were interviewed alongside, you know, the other theorists. I don't know how many people watched you, but it was a lot of people. Did you ever envisage that there would be so much interest in this, in something that, you know, you came up with as, you know, you started on as a graduate student?
Totally beyond my imagination. And what was inspiring about the whole thing is that people were interested. It shows that for all the problems we're having now, all the economic problems, all the obvious displacements that we're having in society because of the rapid advances of technology, that people still have a sense of wonder that they can stand it all and appreciate uncovering the secrets of what we are, how we're made, what the universe is. It was wonderful. And, it gives me hope because clearly all of us now can wonder and hope for more than just survival, right? It was fantastic. It was good, and I made a comment to this effect. It's good to see this sort of enthusiasm at more than just at a football game. I mean, that's great at a football game, but to see it for physics, who would ever think?
Thank you to Jerry Goralnik for sharing his memories with Zia. You know, I'm surprised Werner Heisenberg was so adamantly against the model.
Why? Because it was so clearly right?
No, I just figured Heisenberg would be more uncertain.
That's terrible.
I should move on, shouldn't I?